everybody. This is a new one. You can see us if you want to. And actually, it's probably worth it today because we've got a very special guest. And anybody who knows their AF Onions will be able to see who we have as the third person with us today. We've been told that marketing works better if you show people what you look like. Is that a good thing, Kelly?
I don't know.
We're here now. Talk him a wave. Like blankety blank. Hello, everybody. Hope you're all okay. Welcome to Alcohol Uncensored. I don't want to spend too much time waffling today. I messaged Kelly and said we've got to keep the waffle to a minimum because we've got someone with us today who we need to get our best use of for the next hour maximum that we're going to give ourselves because everyone's time's precious and we don't want to spend too much time with it waffling on. So that's enough of it from me. Hello, I'm Ian. I am coming up to 6 years alcohol-free. 29th of May 2020 was the last day I had a drink. And before I introduce our guest, obviously the video gives it away. So anybody who's watching on video, all this preamble is completely pointless. But let me just say, this guy really did get my alcohol-free streak off to a great start because it was the book that made everything tick for me. And we'll come on, we'll talk about all of that. So without further ado, let me introduce you to Kelly. Good day, Kelly. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. I'm enjoying this lovely sunny weather, hence why I've got the bright colours on today. I'm good. I'm 192 days sober today and feeling really good. So, yeah, I'm not going to say much. I didn't realise I was such a waffler until we started this podcast. So I'm going to keep the waffling to a very minimum so that we can talk to William.
Is it really because of the summer weather you've got that fancy blouse on?
It really is. It really is.
Right. You sure?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Nothing to do with us going live on the video and our special guest.
Listen, Ian, you don't know. You've been getting out in video all week. You've been getting out in video for the past couple of weeks. You just don't know about it.
Really? Yeah. You're joking.
All over social media.
I've had my sort of best loungewear on.
It's just your head. Just your head.
Okay, all right. Right, let's introduce our guest. Today we have got none other than William Porter. Alcohol Uncensored is in the big league, Kelly. We're in the big league. Yep. We're in with the Premiership. Yeah, we've gone up a peg. I'm going red on the with embarrassment because I'm so excited. William, hello, how are you?
I've got what a build up. What can I say? Jeez.
Well, it's all true.
Thank you. Nice to see you both.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you so much for joining us today. We do really appreciate it because I'm sure your time is precious. I'm sure you get loads of requests and I'm sure you've got lots of other things to do than talk to people like us all the time. But I think really it is so appreciated that you're able to do this and give us the chance to continually get the message out there about the many benefits that kick in when you stop drinking. And that is what Alcohol Uncensored is all about, really, Kelly, isn't it? That's what we promote.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, it really is appreciated. As you know, William, we kind of, the group was formed on the back of OTI, over the influence. And I know you were a guest on there at least twice, yes. Maybe even three times. I think you were.
It might have been three. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. 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 So you know how all this works. And I think what we wanted to do today, if it's okay with you, is probably break it into three sections and maybe talk a bit about your own story in terms of drinking and what got you to stopping drinking those years ago and the a bit of your backstory as much as you're willing to share. Talk about the charade and the fallacy and the stupidity, really, quite frankly, of drinking, because you know I've been re-listening to the book over the last few days just to get prepped for this chat. And I'm just listening back and just thinking, why do people drink? But let's come on to that. And then let's leave some time at the end to answer some questions from some people within the Alcohol Uncensored community who very kindly put some questions together for you, William. So brace yourself for that. Do you mind if we just start by talking a bit about you and your sort of backstory, if that's all right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, so I... to give a bit of info, so I turned 50 just a few weeks ago, so that gives you my age, and I quit drinking in 2014, so about 12 years sober. In fact, my birthday's in February and I quit drinking in February as well, so it's all nice and easy to remember for me. When I quit drinking, I don't know how much detail I was going to go into, but I was drinking obviously very heavily. Interesting. I was never drinking every day. I was always a binge drinker. So even at my heaviest, I would crawl out of these binges on a Sunday, Monday, even a Tuesday, and sort of sober up and go back to work. But the drinking was getting worse and worse. It started off as just like weekend drinking. And then I suppose the timeline was teenager, you go out and get as drunk as you can on Friday, and then Saturday you go to the pub as well and really struggle to drink anything because you are still hungover from the day before. And then fast forward a few years, and suddenly the drinking on the Saturday doesn't seem quite so distasteful. And in fact, it's quite nice to get rid of the previous day's hangover. Fast forward a few more years, and that enjoyment of the Saturday drinking away the Friday hangover spills over into Sunday. So you start having a few drinks on Sunday. And then, of course, you're waking up hungover on Monday and bringing in sick if you're too hungover to go in, and then drinking again. So that's basically what happened. It was almost like constant drinking. Because people often ask about the research I did to write the book, but I didn't ever do any research to write the book. I just researched out of interest. So when I started drinking and smoking when I was 14. And I think I was about 16. It was only a couple of years later that I read Alan Carr's Easy Way to Stop Smoking. And that was, I found that absolutely mind-blowing because he just took such a sort of pragmatic, common sense approach to what was otherwise such a confusing, baffling situation. And I ended up reading, I think, virtually everything he's ever written. I just was fascinated by it. That's kind of a side story. And then so I stopped smoking but carried on drinking. And I think all I did over the years was kind of analyze. It was almost, a lot of it's just self-analysis, just looking at how it's affecting me, what it's doing to me, why I keep going back to it. Yeah, and that then it just all sort of cobbled together. So I stopped, as I say, stopped drinking about 12 years ago, expecting it. My mindset when I quit was that I can't keep doing this. I can't, I'm going to lose my job. I'm going to lose my family. It's getting worse and worse. But unfortunately, now I'm never going to enjoy social situations because I'm not particularly outgoing. And I always needed alcohol in a social situation. So I'm just not going to enjoy social situations anymore. And same with like going on holiday and Christmas. I was just accepting that I can't drink anymore. And the downside to that is I won't enjoy anything ever again. But surprise, surprise, that wasn't the case at all. So I kind of had done all the research and learning before quitting and then cobbled it together with what became apparent after quitting, to hopefully, yeah, to come up with kind of like a full picture of it all.
Just what you were saying there about the sort of the drinking sort of at events and sort of not being able to relax without drinking and stuff, and that was me. And the binge drinking, the drinking on a weekend and just weekends just continually circulating around drinking all the time, and it just gets more and more progressive, doesn't it? And more and more sort of so it's just ingrained in your eating, it just catches up with you without you really sort of realizing. So what was it that made you sort of decide enough was enough, and how did you go about it? Because if it was back in 2014, obviously it was before we had all the benefit of all things like this. So how did you approach it?
So I went to AA on a couple of occasions. But I think really what, I mean, we could unpick it for hours and hours, I think. But one of the points that strikes me in retrospect that allowed me to quit was because of the kind of understanding I had of the physiological side of it, how alcohol is a sedative, but your brain reacts to it by becoming oversensitive. And then when the alcohol wears off, there's that corresponding feeling of anxiety. Because I had a good grasp of that, and I also had a good grasp of how badly alcohol impacts your sleep and how better you feel a few days after stopping when that all starts to repair itself. And I had the practical experience that I was a binge drinker. So I knew for a fact, for all of the above reasons, that when I quit, I would feel dreadful and probably feel worse over the next few days, but there would be an upturn in it. So I think for me, the thing that allowed me to quit was just real faith in the system, because I think that must be, for me, that must be one of the most horrendous things to be in the situation I was then in at that time. When I quit, I was quite in a bad way physically, like really shaky. I couldn't sleep at all. And I can't imagine what it must be like to be in that situation, but not to understand the dynamic that it gets better over time. Because if I just stopped and this is what life is, not drinking, I wouldn't want to live that life. I'd just keep drinking. There would be no point living like that because I was absolutely riddled with anxiety and fear and depression. So, as I say, waffling on a bit, but I think it was that faith in the system, that knowledge that things will get better, that allowed me to quit.
Can I ask a question on that actually? Because I've got a theory around it, and it's one of the reasons why I'm so passionate about this community. Can I ask, like, what was your views on AA? Like, obviously you went and didn't stick to going, you didn't keep going. So what was your kind of views and your reasons for not remaining there?
So very high level, I found it really, really invaluable to be able to speak to someone that knew what I was going through and had been through it. Because that's the thing, particularly back in 2014, there was no online communities or anything for getting sober. It was you did it on your own. And to be able to actually sit down with someone and be saying, you know, I'm drinking like this, I'm doing this, I'm drinking in the mornings, I'm drinking through the night, and them to say, yes, that's what I did, was really powerful. I think where I struggled a bit was I don't mind doing anything if I can see the reason for it. So when I was being told you need to work the steps, you need to do this, I was happy to do it, but I kind of wanted to understand why. And I think that's what makes things powerful for me. If I understand the why, I'll absolutely go for it. So, and the other thing I found was, so it was kind of helpful in one way, not so helpful in the other way. I thought I had the tools to quit successfully without it, and fortunately I did. But the other thing I found was it really differed depending on what meeting you were at. So I went to some meetings that were pretty awful, to be honest, and the other meetings that were really uplifting and good. So it's a kind of, it was a mixed bag for me, but I suppose one of the main reasons I stopped going was I had two very young children at the time and a full-time job, and going to regular meetings was difficult to manage. And I obviously would have done it if my sobriety relied on it, but fortunately it didn't. So.
The reason I ask is I do go to AA now, which took me a long time. I only started going to AA this year. I first got sober, as we've spoke about loads of times, through a community, a positive community, like Over the Influence, and I learned to really enjoy life without alcohol, in terms of it wasn't a case of when you remove alcohol from life, your life, it gets boring. It was the opposite. It opened up my world. Obviously, the other issues and my alcohol progressed so far over the years that I kind of needed something else, and I learned that. And the reason what it got me thinking was, I'm going through the program just now, and I'm on 12, on step four. And on step four, you go through, it's like you go through an inventory, and it's like you go through all the kind of amends that you need to make, the people you've hurt, the mistakes you've made, your regret, shame. And when I look at you, your drinking was, when I listened to you, sorry, your drinking was very similar to mine. I was a weekend binge drinker. I didn't drink through the week. And it did progress to taking a Monday off, and then it would keep into a Tuesday. And then eventually it kept into, I was sometimes drinking a week at a time. And I would go big periods without alcohol, like months at a time, and then start drinking again. And now when I'm doing my inventory, I've got a list that size because I allowed my alcohol. And I know it's allowed, I say that lightly because I know it's an illness and I do believe that now. But my alcohol addiction progressed so far that I feel that I do need to go through the steps, because I've caused so much hurt, and I've got a lot of shame and regret in my life. And I just wonder, and I just hope that by getting communities like this and people like you speaking and educating, that we can catch people. Because it is like that. We say, like, we call the meetings your medicine for your illness. And sometimes the medicine tastes good and sometimes it doesn't. Meaning some meetings are rubbish and some are good. And I only really go to one, maybe two meetings a week that I enjoy. But it's not always the most positive place. And the hope is that not as many people progress to the depths that you need to go to AA, like how you felt and how I felt. So having communities like this where we can sing about the joys of sobriety and talk about the benefits of removing alcohol. So that's kind of where I was going with it. My point is trying to catch people before it has to go there. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I think you're doing exactly the right thing as well, because to my mind, recovery shouldn't be a fixed menu of alcohol explained or this or AA or anything. It should
Yeah.
be more like a buffet because we're
Yeah.
all different. We all have different tastes. We all have different needs. And I think that's how you should address it. You should go in and just cherry pick the things and sort of build your own bespoke recovery. Like
Yeah.
what you're saying about the amends, that's absolutely fantastic. So being able to do that, being able to sort of pick and choose and do something that works, I think is the, yeah, that's for me, I think the most powerful thing.
Yeah.
I think it's a good point you make, Kenny, because at the moment it's almost like a cliff edge, isn't it? It's everybody who's doesn't drink, and then there's all those who pretend drinking isn't causing them any bother. And then there's this big cliff drop or something, and then AA is something that nobody else ever talks about because it's kind of seen as something, sort of no, nobody wants to sort of admit that they're anywhere close to it when, it is it's a trajectory, isn't it, if you know what I mean? So I think you're absolutely bang on raising it. It's a good thing to bring up.
I think you're absolutely right. The way society sees it is very black and white. You either have a problem with drinking or you don't. But it's not that simple. It's a, massive gray area getting increasingly, from black to white. Huge. Yeah. Well, it's a similar thing as well, because when I talk about alcohol withdrawal, people immediately think of, DTs and seizures and the really extreme stuff. And obviously that is part of alcohol withdrawal, but it's not the only alcohol withdrawal. You don't go from nothing to that just one day. It's a sliding scale of increasing anxiety, et cetera, until it gets to that kind of level.
Yeah, and it'd be good to actually talk about because obviously you write so well about it in your book, and the thing I love that you've said so many times is that anyone can become addicted, because it's this kind of, and I think it's changing a little bit now, but it's like you're either an alcoholic, an addict, or you're not, and it's so progressive. I mean, I do feel as if I have the genetic predisposition on my side as well, but it was absolutely progressive, and you see it so often. I do think it can happen to anyone, so that's what I love about what you preach.
Thank you.
Just before we move on to sort of talk about the book and be after the book, if you like, but before you managed to stop that time in 2014, William, how many goals and attempts and run-ups and efforts and what had you done yourself to sort of before you got to that point?
It's a hard thing to say because I'd quit for extended periods a few times before that. When I was in the parachute regiment many years ago, and I quit for 3 months building up to that for the selection procedure. And there was other occasions where I'd stopped for some fairly extended periods, but they were never an attempt to quit forever. I would always say to myself, I'm going to take a break and I will go back to it in the future. And I think that day in 2014 was the first and only time I realized I couldn't go back to it, if that makes sense. And I know that sounds odd because I mean, I'm always saying to people, it's perfectly normal to try and quit and to fail, do it over and over again until you finally get there and then say, well, I actually did it on the first go. But I don't think it's quite as simple as that, because as I say, I was stopping for some extended periods and but always with the caveat that I would go back to it. So it's a difficult one, really. As I say, there was a lot of funny enough, I never tried to moderate ever, and I know that's something a lot of people do, and that's something else I didn't do, because many years ago, I remember going out and just having, I'll drive, so I just have one. And I really didn't like it. I didn't like the feeling of one drink. I would rather not bother. So I kind of knew very well that it was an all or nothing thing. So I never even attempted moderation, which I know is a bit unusual, but yeah.
No, it's a makes
Moderation
sense.
is a hard one as well, though, isn't it? Because it's like people's view of moderation is completely different. Some people's view of moderation is like, I'll go out and I'll have one drink. Some people, my kind of view of moderation was like, well, I'll have a few weeks off it and then I'll just drink like a normal person on a Saturday night. And it never happens like that. I always drunk for like 2 and 3 days. But yeah, it's a large conversation in itself, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a big word, moderation,
Yeah.
isn't it? There's an awful lot falling under that
Yeah.
umbrella.
Yeah. Can we focus on, well, when I say the book, there are three books, aren't they? There's Alcohol Explained 2, and a personal favourite of mine is Diet and Fitness Explained as well, which isn't why we're here today. Maybe that's one for another day,
Another
William, if you
topic,
don't
yeah,
mind, because that's
absolutely,
all right. But it was a personal favourite of mine. But I think, tell me if I'm wrong, but I think Alcohol Explained 2 is the one that kind of, to me, if you're going to pick one, I think that's the one that you would pick, because it updates the first, doesn't it? And then I think it sort of includes all the points that you raise in the first. But can we just sort of talk for a bit for the people who are listening about, like I said before, about the alcohol as a substance and how it kind of really, when you boil it down into what it actually is, it's so ridiculous that we sort of give it so much credit. Do you mind just explaining to people a bit about the
Absolutely.
sort of the reality of alcohol, if you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So it's a carcinogen, so class one carcinogen. So the World Health Organization classifies things as how carcinogenic they are to human beings, and alcohol's in class one, which is the same as asbestos and cigarette smoking. So it's not a particularly pleasant substance. It is a sedative, so it's a drug. And I think these days people are a bit more happy to accept that it's a drug. But years ago, people didn't even think of alcohol as being a drug. You just talk about alcohol and drugs. But it absolutely is a drug, and it's a sedative. So there's many, many, many different types of drugs, but a lot of them will fall quite neatly into one of two categories. They will either be stimulants, so things that make you feel more alert and more awake, so caffeine, nicotine, amphetamines, stimulants, and then you've got the sedatives. So these are things that calm things down and deaden the senses. Alcohol, and obviously all the anesthetics and even mild painkillers, the opioids, they're all sedatives. Okay, so alcohol is sat there as this particular sedative. So that's why when you drink it, it makes you feel, some people would say, relaxed. It's usually the situation you drink it in which will dictate how you feel. Because if you're sat there perfectly relaxed and you have a sedative, it's not going to do much of anything. But if you're feeling a bit uptight and nervous and you have a sedative, it will have an apparent effect because it's anaesthetizing that nervousness. So that's why alcohol suits very well to social situations, apparently, because of that aspect. And that's really, I think, where most people get to with it. They just understand it as this thing that you drink and it kind of makes me feel good. But where it gets a bit more interesting is how the brain reacts to it, because the brain, human brain, creates and excretes a huge array of chemicals, drugs, and hormones. So these are naturally occurring things. So things you would have heard about, like adrenaline. So adrenaline's a naturally occurring stimulant. You get a shot of adrenaline in you from your brain, and your heart rate goes up, etc., etc. There's lots and lots of these chemicals and drugs and hormones that your brain creates and excretes. And there's a huge amount we humans don't understand about the process. But what we do know is the brain works by way of something called homeostasis, which is a balancing act of all these different chemicals, drugs, and hormones. So when you drink alcohol, which is a sedative, your brain tries to counter it. And it does it in lots of different ways. It releases adrenaline, which is a stimulant. It releases cortisol, which is a stress hormone. But what it's really trying to do is counter the sedating effects of the alcohol so it can maintain that delicate chemical balance, which is all very well. But the problem is then when the alcohol wears off, those additional stimulants are still sat in your system. And that's the key, to my mind, the key dynamic about alcohol is whatever relaxed, sedated effect you get when you consume it, there's a corresponding feeling of anxiety then when it wears off. And obviously that feeling of anxiety, that withdrawal, will depend on how much you've drunk before. Because if you've had one glass of wine, it's a fairly relatively low level feeling of sedation, and it will be a corresponding low level feeling of anxiety. But if you're drinking two, three, four bottles of wine or a bottle of spirits, that withdrawal the next day, that overstimulation is going to feel pretty pronounced. And that's why drinkers tend to wake up at about 5 hours after they go to bed. They usually find they're awake. Because alcohol has a half-life of 5 hours. So after 5 hours, the amount of alcohol in your system is halved, and that's usually when people start waking up completely unable to get back to sleep.
Yeah.
Do you know, I'm listening to you there and I was actually feeling a bit queasy. And we talk all the time in the community about all these benefits of having lots of energy and being able to eat healthier and get out running and exercise. But just that waking up in the morning without the anxiety and a peace of mind is just that's what we're aiming for, isn't it? I could actually, it just reminded me of waking up and the anxiety that I used to get, even before it progressed to like when I was waking up and wanting another drink. But the anxiety, I used to be really fearful and worried, and I would be thinking, I've not left the house since yesterday, so what am I worried or fearful about? It's horrible.
It, because it's chemically created, even if you've got nothing to worry about, your brain will find something, or you'll just feel horrible for no reason because it's you're not anxious because of a specific reason in your life. You're anxious because of this chemical imbalance in your brain.
It takes me back, William, to sort of, like I say, like end of 6 years ago, when my job, and you hear this all the time, you probably try not to roll your eyes, please, but my job involved a lot of networking that I used to tell my wife and anybody else who would listen was very important, and it meant business, all that sort of nonsense. So I used to go out on, let's say, a Thursday night and have a load of drink, and then wake up at like 3, 4 o'clock in the morning, and sort of be absolutely sort of. Like we joked about it. We used to call it the bears. The bears, the basement of the sort of this, the chains were these bears were rattling because all these thoughts would then come to my mind of all these things that I might have said to people and who I might have upset and had I been inappropriate and I'd done the wrong thing and all this and then that would and then on a Friday I might be going out socially with friends or I would need some drinks on a weekend and just in the house just to sort of calm myself down again. And then Saturday, well, Saturday. So, you need to have a drink on a Saturday, don't you? And let's find an excuse to go out at 3 o'clock and do something that involves drinking. And then, well, Sunday, I'm absolutely exhausted. Before I go to work, I need to calm myself down with more drink. And you summarized this in your book. I was listening to it earlier on today and I thought, my God, that was me. And you're describing everybody, aren't you? But it just so easily described my drinking habits that Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday were just a write-off. And then I would do well by thinking I don't have a drink problem because I don't have a drink Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, might not drink on the Thursday, but then Friday, it would all start again. And it's just, even talking about it now, I'm feeling like, oh my God,
Exhausting,
that
isn't
was
it?
so tiring. Oh, but it's crazy, isn't it? And yet, let's get on to the sort of the aura the drinking has, if you like, the sort of the marketability of it. It's everywhere, isn't it? And I think this is why I'm so keen and Kelly's so keen to have these conversations, is because we're not the only three people who think like this. We're not the only ones who think it has actually come on alcohol, the game's up. It's like it doesn't have to be like this, but it is still, like you say, 90% of the certainly the Western world seem to think that you can't have a drink, you can't have fun without drinking. It's crazy, isn't it? And that's what we're up against.
Yeah, and I think one of the biggest problems with this is you've got like, I can't remember what it is, like 86, 87% of the adult population drink. But like any drug, when people are taking it, they are protective of it. It's like an abusive relationship where people sort of are very defensive to anyone on the outside coming in. Because at the end of the day, and we've all, this is not to judge people, we've all been in this situation, you want to keep drinking. When you wake up feeling horrible, you want to drink. And so you're making excuses, oh, it helps me relax, it's good for me, whatever it is, justifying it to other people and to yourself. So people are very protective of their drug of choice. And when you've got a situation where like 87% of the population are all in the same boat, you can get that collective mindset that, oh, it's fine, there's not a problem with it. Because there's quite often, the trouble is as well, these days it's social media. So what you get when you open your device is based on an algorithm of what other people like and share. So if people like something, you're more likely to get it shoved into your face when you open your phone in the morning. I remember seeing this, was a long time ago, but there was a post saying something like glass of red wine is good for you, that nonsense. So I went back to the site and it was one of these just random sites where they're constantly putting out like little sound bites almost in the hopes that people will like and share so they can get more advertising revenue. And the previous post to that was someone saying about how they'd quit drinking and how great life was. So it's like, okay, well, they're doing a balanced view. But the problem is, the thing about saying red wine was good for you had tens of thousands of likes and thousands of shares, but the one about someone saying I've quit drinking and I feel great, no one was interested in it. So that's the problem we've got, which we didn't have, 10, 15 years ago. You've got 87% of the people drinking, and therefore they have a vested interest in almost portraying alcohol to be good and benign and fun. And you've got a situation where the more people that like and encourage something, the more it gets sort of shoved under your nose.
You said there, William, about being protective of our drinking. Do you think that's on like a, I don't know, it'll probably change when people kind of start to review their relationship with alcohol, but do you think it's on like a conscious or subconscious level? The reason I ask is we had a conversation in the community and somebody was talking about how they had a drink. And it was like we were kind of reviewing like, well, what made you have a drink when you'd had like a good break? And it was along the lines of, well, I'd just been thinking the sun was out and people were in the garden and having a drink and just all this social thoughts of, oh, that would be nice. And then the question was, well, where did you have a drink? Where you socialised when you had the drink? And it turned out actually that they just sat at home with a bottle of wine. So
Yeah,
it's like the brain
absolutely.
tricks you. Now, I don't
Yeah.
believe for a minute that, but I don't think. It's like it's a difficult one. It's like I don't think, I know for me, I wasn't consciously protecting my drinking. So on a subconscious level somewhere, I certainly was.
Yeah. I think a lot of it is subconscious, and a lot of it I think is almost like a self-defense mechanism. So go back 15 years, I'm waking up on a Saturday feeling absolutely dreadful and knowing that I'm going to need a drink to get through the day. I've got a choice. I can either look at that and think I'm addicted to this drug. It's a carcinogen. It's really bad for me. It's ruining my sleep. It's destroying my life, but I have to have it. Or I can shift my perspective and say, oh, everyone drinks, and a drink in the morning, ooh, it's a bit off, but some people do it anyway, and alcohol, in moderation is good for you, so it must be better for you to drink loads and loads. So it's very easy to shift your perspective. And why would you adopt a situation that makes you feel even worse? So you take the drink and you say, it's fine, everything's okay. Look at all these other people drinking, it's all good. So I think shifting the perspective is almost a necessity. I don't think people do it consciously. I think it's just that it's a, like I say, a self-defense mechanism. You've literally at that point got a choice, because let's remember as well, at this point, we're not talking about someone who's trying to quit. That's a very different mindset, because when people want to quit, they then start to look at the reality. This is someone who, like me 15 years ago, had no intention of quitting, and I just wanted an excuse to drink that day.
It's a different because it's like one of those things. Sometimes you think it's not until you analyze, like we have a lot of conversations in the community about these things. It's not until you actually start talking to people and saying, well, what led to you? What was the triggers? What led to you to having a drink? And the picture, the reason you thought you had the drink is often changes as you talk it out. But a lot of the time, it's like you've had a drink before you know it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, there's quite a lot of information on where decisions are made, like obviously psychologically where decisions are made. And if you take someone and sit them down and talk them through and ask them to make a decision, imagine a timeline where you give them information, they sit back and think about it, and then they make the decision. People always say the decision is made quite late on. So I've got the information, I've thought it over, and I've made the decision. But actually, the reality is the decision gets made way earlier than that. Almost as soon as the things that you've already, chances are you've already got a prejudice, you've already got some kind of belief in what the answer should be. And then as the information comes in, you're usually sort of cherry picking. So positive bias confirmation, where when you believe something, you kind of focus more on stuff that supports it. That those decisions are often made a lot. And I think it's Alcohol Explained too. I talk about this, what I call the search for excuses. There's a difference between saying to yourself, shall I have a drink? Okay, I want to sit down and think about whether to do it. Because what I realized is a lot of the time when I was going through that process, it wasn't to make a decision, it was to justify a decision that had already been made. I knew in my heart of hearts I was going to drink, and I was just sort of going through a thought process to soften the blow a bit and make it look a bit more palatable.
It's just it's our brains are out to trick us for sure. I did a blog about it on the website actually, and it was around, I was going through a really, it was a kind of stressful situation, and I was on my way there, and I was thinking, I mean, given what I've just been through with my alcoholism, I was going somewhere, and I thought, a couple of drinks just to, oh, just make me feel better, just to deal with this. And then I was like, Kelly, don't be so stupid. So obviously I didn't have a drink. And then later on, when the thing had finished, I was like so relieved, and I had an hour to wait in the train, and I was like, maybe I should just go and have a glass of wine while I'm waiting. So it was, it went from
Yeah.
1 minute, it was like to make me feel better, and then next minute my brain was trying to sell it on, let's celebrate because you've just went through this. It's
Yeah.
bonkers.
You get dragged back to it either way. And the person you were saying about as well, with like, that thing, oh, everyone's drinking, it's a lovely day, and then just sitting at home with a bottle of wine drinking. I think that's one of the dynamics I mentioned before about how different a mindset it is to say, I'm quitting for good to I'm quitting for a bit. Because when you're quitting for a bit, you're just dangling that carrot in front of you. But I remember doing the same thing. And in that situation where you've said to yourself, right, I'm never doing it again. And then you look at people in a pub and think, pub garden, it's a lovely, but I don't want to miss out on that. And then the mindset goes, okay, well, you're going to drink again. You'll be drinking again. And then the next thing is, okay, well, I'll get a drink. And it's strange. It's exactly that. But I completely understand that mentality. Of, oh, you had the drink and you enjoyed the beer garden, did you? No, I sat at home and had it. But it's that we're sucked in, we're sold this image. And I think this is a great example of how what you miss about alcohol is not the reality when you go back to it. Because for that person, they're sat there, and what's dragged them in is a thought of sitting in a beer garden having a lovely time. And instead, they find themselves sat at home drinking a bottle of wine, which I imagine was probably quite depressing, really, particularly after the bottle's gone and you think, oh God, right back to square one. And I think that's one of the important things. A lot of what we have in life, it's the idea and not the reality that drags us in.
I'll be honest, it was now the weather's getting nicer again. I think it might have been today, or it was yesterday. I was driving past somewhere and just out of nowhere, a thought came to me. I thought, I would like to go and sit in a beer garden and have a beer. And it was like, I'm not going to do that. I will
No.
not drink again. I will not drink again.
It's not a very good advert for this podcast
Well,
if
no, but I think it is, because
you do
bear with me, bear with me.
eat.
I think it's one of those things, isn't it? I don't think it ever leaves you, really. Is this something in William, you can probably explain it quite well, but where does that come from? 6 years on, I know all the bad sides. I know I don't want to go. I know I'll never go to the bar and order a drink. So why is my mind telling me, see, that looks a good idea?
So, short answer is conditioning. So, if you do something over and over again, it becomes implanted in your subconscious. And I think the example I give in the book is driving. So, hopefully, most people listening to this can relate to this. But if you're a driver and you're sat in the passenger seat of a car and the driver's driving too fast or too close to the vehicle in front, your leg keeps tensing, like air braking. You're trying to brake, but there's no brake there. And it's just you've learned over however many hours and hours you've been in a vehicle that tensing your right leg will slow the vehicle down. So your brain just jumps on and does that. And what you've described is, yeah, don't forget how many hundreds of hours you would have spent drinking and looking for excuses like that to allow you to drink. And then when it comes up, it's going to keep coming up years and years down the line. But I think what is really important is you said the thought was there, but you knew you weren't going to do it. And I think that's the important thing, because I spend, I don't know, 80% because of what I do, 80% of my waking hours thinking about alcohol. But what I don't spend any time doing is seriously considering whether to have a drink or not. And I think people can find that, people might be listening to that thinking, oh, 6 years and you're still getting these urges. When will it ever end? But I think the answer is it may never end, but it doesn't matter. Because thinking about being in a beer garden and having a drink is not a problem as long as you know you're not going to do it. You don't sit there fantasizing about it. It's just a thought, and thoughts don't need to have power over you. So I think that's the key thing. Funnily enough, so I'm 12, 12 years since my drink. And one of the things I had never done, I used to go away with my parents. The whole family would go and get a cottage somewhere, and we'd go there and we'd drink loads and have a great time and then go home afterwards. And I hadn't done that. And we went and did a weekend away with the cottage. So this is the first time I'd done it since, even though it was 12 years. And then, because what I find is it's the new experiences, and when you've done them sober, it's okay. But the first time is always, there's challenges in it. And strange enough, that had challenges for me, because it's like, this is going to be weird. I'm going to be away with my mum and dad and sisters and not drinking. What are we going to do all day? So I knew I wasn't going to drink, but it was just a new thing to do, even after 12 years.
I think that's why the community is so important as well, because a lot of my friends and people who I still sort of, remain in regular contact with, a lot of them are my old friends, if you like, from the drinking days. And I think a lot of it's kind of, it's that conditioning that you're talking about there. It's often, whenever they mention something, it's always with reference to the days we were drinking. And it's kind of that constant reminder of something that doesn't really feel part of me anymore. And it's not nothing against them, lovely people. There's so much, I'm not saying the whole world needs to stop drinking. I'm not saying that.
I
But
am.
well, we'll get there one step at a time, Kelly. But it's and I think that's why this community is so important. It's nothing about I need to be part of this community because I need it to make sure I don't drink. It's not that at all. It's somewhere where I can go where I don't have to have this constant like mirror put up to me all the time, William, if you know what I mean, of what you used to be and how you used to how you've changed and stuff. It's just a place just to sort of just relax a bit, really, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and it's, I think the communities are so very important as well, because I mentioned before about society's got this image of alcohol they're trying to portray, and it's lovely to have a group of people or a place you can go where that's not happening.
I think as well, when you come on, we know that I was never a big talker, and it's one of those you come on a Zoom with nothing to say, because we've regular Zooms throughout the week most days, and you come on with nothing to say, and then you end up just talking the ears off each other, and there's always something that you take away from it. And it's a kind of reminder sometimes as well for people that are in kind of longer into their journey of removing alcohol from their life, that God, that's what it used to feel like. Do you know? So it goes both ways. The people in the early days get the benefit of the people that are alcohol free for longer, and vice versa. I've got a question actually, William. What's your view on the progression? Because obviously, when we start drinking, it does progress. It's progressive, and we always say that kind of addiction can get a hold of anyone. What do you think is the cause of the progression? Is it just that we get greedier, or?
No, I think it's a purely physiological process. So explained at the beginning how the brain doesn't like alcohol and it tries to counter it when you drink it. When you first in your life ever have a drink, you have like one or two beers and you're ooh, off you go. It's because your brain's never encountered alcohol before and it's a new substance and it doesn't really know what to do with it. But as you drink it regularly, your brain becomes better and better at countering it. And that's what tolerance is. This is one of the interesting things. I mean, everyone knows, me at 14 having my first drink, I don't know what I can't even remember now, but maybe, I don't know, one or two beers. And like I said, I would have been pretty much off, I would think, on that. And then fast forward 30 years and I'm sat there drinking bottles of spirits all, in the afternoon and still walking around afterwards. I couldn't have done that at 14. It would have killed me. And stopping and thinking, well, what's changed is quite interesting because everyone accepts that tolerance happens and you can drink more and more, but not many people stop and think why. But the reason for that is, like I say, the brain just becomes better and better at countering the effects of the alcohol. But the knock-on effects of that, there's a few that are quite key. One of them is you need more to get the same effect because your brain's countering it. So if you like that, first time I ever drunk, had two drinks and I felt really good. A few months down the line, you're going to be needing to drinking double that just to get to the same place, let alone go beyond it. And then obviously the other thing is the withdrawal gets worse because, like I said, a glass of wine withdrawal is fairly minor, but a bottle of spirits withdrawal is going to be absolutely horrendous. So it's that process. And I think that's one of the things that's so difficult about it is, with moderation, the natural tendency with any drug is to take more and more of it because as you become increasingly tolerant to it, you need more to take the same effect. To even stay at the same intake for any kind of extended period is really difficult because if you're drinking because I like this effect, like I say, a couple of months in, you're not getting that effect from the same amount of drink.
Yeah, and generally it is for effect, isn't it? I mean, I suppose probably the natural moderators are people that just sit with half a glass and don't drink anymore. The majority of us do it for some sort of effect, whether it's
Yes, I feel
relaxation
it.
or we speak to a lot of mums in the community as well, where they used to have pour a glass of wine just so they could get on with cooking dinner and getting the
Yeah.
ironing done. And men as well, but we speak to a lot of women, and it's like that. It's for some sort of effect. Most of us do it, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. That's it. If you're drinking purely, I don't know, just for the taste or something, then you'll be one of the lucky people that, like you say, have a glass of wine, it sits there and doesn't really get touched.
Scary, isn't it? I'm just thinking, listening to the talk about the progressive nature of it, and by the end, if you like, got to the point for me, it was just it's you're scared of the. I mean, I was what age am I now? I'm 54, so I was 48, 49 when I stopped drinking. I've been drinking since I was 15, 16 year old, so a long time. It's a step out into the wilderness, isn't it, William? In terms of just if you've made that decision, and I know, yeah, I hear what you're saying about don't say take it day at a time, just call it as it is and say I'm stopping. But sometimes you don't verbalize that. You just want to sort of keep that thought to yourself. But if you know that's what you're intending to do, it's a scary step to take, isn't it? Because you're
It
just
really is.
all those habits that you've got, all that, it's that it, it it's everything to you, isn't it? It's just like it's a protection against everything.
Yeah,
And
I mean, I think I'm fairly typical in that two of the big reasons I drank. One, like I say, I was never particularly sociable, so I struggled in social situations. So alcohol was my way of dealing with social situations, and it was also my stress relief. So when I was as stressed or unhappy, I'd have a drink. And they're two big parts of people's lives: dealing with stress and interacting with other people. They're quite big, and for like 30 years, alcohol was my tool for doing that. So it wasn't just cutting alcohol out. Then you've got to almost learn from scratch how you socialize without alcohol and how you, I don't know, have a terrible day at work and don't have a drink off the back of it. You're having to relearn these tools that you had, we did have them previously because everyone was able to socialize and deal with stress before they started drinking. But you have to go back and sort of relearn them. And it's huge. It's a big, intimidating thing.
Talk about Dutch courage, having a drink to be able to be brave enough to do things that you wouldn't ordinarily do without alcohol, and that list of things you wouldn't be brave enough to do gets bigger and bigger, doesn't it? Because your confidence becomes less and less, and you shrink, don't you, really, into something such a smaller version of yourself. But it happens over such a long period of time, and because you're on the inside looking out, you can't see it. I could this is how it applied to me. So only now looking back and thinking, God, it was taking so much away from me, and yet I gave it so much credit. It was just ridiculous, really.
Think that's one of the big things for me looking back is just quality of life. And you kind of know when you're drinking that it's not doing you any favors and you'd be better off without it. But I think I didn't appreciate how much better my life would be when I quit. Just as simple as whatever mental health I've got, I'm okay. And then I introduce this drug and it ruins your sleep, it ruins your brain chemistry, it does all this stuff to you and just drags you down massively. And I didn't appreciate, because again, being a binge drinker, so I drink at weekends and my understanding was, okay, obviously wake up Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, feeling awful, but by Thursday, I'm kind of back on and feeling okay, but back to normal. And it wasn't until I quit for an extended period that I realized that that Thursday feeling that I thought I was 100%, I was maybe at 60%. And actually, I needed weeks of good quality sleep, of not interfering with my brain chemistry, to realize how far I'd actually sunk.
Can I ask you some of these questions that
Yes.
the community members have asked us to pitch in? I'll
Keep them
start
clean
with.
because I've seen a few coming through and they're not for broadcast.
Have you seen the X-rated ones? Have you? They've not some of them. All right. No, I'll keep these clean.
Mind
I think they're
boggles.
clean. Oh, you've got quite a following, William. Right. So this first one's from Rich Gross, and Rich was on episode 40, four, I'm going to guess, Kelly, when we started doing the
Perfect.
podcast. And Rich is one of our Zoom hosts in the community, and he's a top man. He was a former US Army paratrooper, and obviously he's aware of your time in the British Army as well. You paratrooper, weren't you? Is that
My
right?
parachute regiment, yeah,
Yeah,
absolutely,
yeah, yeah. So his questions to you were, William, you served in the military, which we understand can be a booze-soaked culture. Have you any advice for soldiers and veterans seeking to live an AF lifestyle?
Personally, I think when you leave the military, it is incredibly difficult, and this will be someone who doesn't have any PTSD and didn't lose friends or anything, who's just served in the military for a few years and left. Even that's really difficult because it's a different civilian life is very different to a military life. And I think if you get on with a military life, it's really hard to come back into society. When I got back from Iraq, what I struggled with, it wasn't what had happened out there, it was trying to get back into the civilian mindset of coming back. So it's incredibly difficult. And all my free, yeah, all my fr we've got our 20th year anniversary coming up in next month, I think, for Optelec 7, which is when we were out in Iraq. So I'm going up to Leeds to sort of meet everyone. And they're booze-fueled situations. They really are. There's a lot of alcohol involved in it. And it's hard, but I think all you can really do is just be single-minded with it. You just have to stick with what you're doing. And interestingly, I'm having sort of conversations with people more and more. Obviously, I'm sort of hitting 50, and we're all sort of a similar age group of other people now, sort of knowing what I do and sort of taking me to one side and starting to talk to me about their drinking, which is quite interesting.
Good.
The other thing, of course, is a lot of people from the military will have, for example, PTSD. And this brings up, we could talk about this for hours, but the problem is when you've got a mental health issue, be it PTSD or depression or anxiety, alcohol is a very easy drug to go to because it's a sedative, so it dulls things. So if you're not happy, and that's a huge umbrella term, if you are not happy, alcohol will take the edge off it, whatever that mental health issue might be. So it's incredibly difficult, but PTSD, one of the worst things alcohol does is ruins your sleep. Okay, it destroys your natural sleeping cycles. We've got really time to go into it all now, but suffice to say that when you drink alcohol, you fall unconscious, you don't sleep. Two completely different things. So getting hammered and falling asleep or falling unconscious for the night means you've had zero actual sleep. And what people are doing when they PTSD responds well to lots of things, one of which is good quality sleep because it helps your brain to sort of process things. And it's horrendous to drink alcohol because you're taking away that natural ability for your body to sort of repair things and get to grips with things.
Yeah, thank you for that. Next question we've got is from Anna. Anna says, I would class myself as neurodivergent, obsessive, and impulsive. I'm amazed that I managed to give up alcohol, but that was in many ways because of the influence of William Porter's book. I'm now struggling because of my personality to set other really positive trends in my life, and I was wondering whether he might have some advice for me. As I respond very well to logic, I just can't understand why I struggle so much.
That's a difficult one without a bit more detail of exactly what she might be trying to do. I can talk about my own mindset, maybe like for example about exercise, because obviously it sounds like she's done drinking very well, and it's maybe diet or exercise or something.
I
So
think that's what it is, William. I
is
think
it?
she that's
Okay.
what she's referring to, yeah.
So what I do is I set the alarm every morning and get up early and go for a run. And I know full well when the alarm goes off, I don't want to do it. But I also know I feel better afterwards. I feel good after a run and it feels good all day. And I also know that if I don't go, I kind of feel bad for the rest of the day because I've done myself a disservice and I haven't gone. And between the two, I go because I know that I'll be better off if I do and I won't be happy with myself if I don't. I don't know if that's helpful or not, but that's again the logical approach that I take. What you're
Sorry,
getting out
William.
of it compared to what you're putting in and how it's making you feel.
Your book was, this is why I thought your book was so good, because it was just logical. It was exactly that. It was following logic. And I guess the logic is also not just about drinking, it's about fitness and it's about sort of diet and it's about other things. And I guess maybe Anna's thinking she followed the logic of the book so well, and she knows the logic of good exercise and good this and good that, but maybe it's hard just to put into place. But I suppose it's something that just be kind, being kind on yourself, isn't it? And not expecting too much too quickly sometimes.
Yeah, that's the other thing. I think, and I do say this to people, I'm not encouraging you to give up on exercise at all, but drinking, if you've given up drinking, that's going to have a massive positive influence on your quality of life. Don't beat yourself up over everything, because I think that's another thing I'm pretty good at as well. You tackle one thing and then you're a couple of months in and you're looking at what's next to tackle and now next to improve things. So I think whatever you're doing, it always does you well to stop for a minute and look back over the whole journey and give yourself a bit of a pat on the back for how far you've come, even if you're not quite getting exactly what you want from exercise, for example.
I think that's
I
true.
I think that's spot on, because I think we actually don't sit and think, God, how much have I achieved or what have I done? Because when you remove alcohol from your life, it's difficult to do in a society that's totally drenched in alcohol. And it's difficult as well if you've been using it as a coping mechanism and just to feel better. So the fact that you've done that alone, I think, and I'm sure if Anna looks at what she's achieved over the time that she's been alcohol free, she'll see that she has made a lot of positive change in her life. And I think it is, it's like you said, Ian, it's been kind to yourself and giving yourself kudos and credit for what you've achieved, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely.
Right, bit of a this last question, William, bit of a curveball for you. So this is from Niall, who's another member of the Alcohol and Sensitive Community. It's not really AF related, but it is related, I think, to some of your sort of expertise, if you like. He wants to ask if you've got any marketing and promotion tips for someone who's planning to self-publish their own book. It might not be relevant, but it's a gambling addiction memoir in the final stages of editing. So I think there probably is a good link there, isn't there? The gambling addiction and the alcohol addiction. So you
Absolutely,
probably do have
yeah.
some tips on that front.
I've been asked this a few times, and I have to confess, I don't do marketing. It's just I have tried it, and I've tried to get people to do it, but for some reason, it's just not something I've ever managed to do. I was incredibly lucky with Alcohol Explained. I think it was partly when I wrote it because there wasn't much else at the time, but it was almost like the start of that sober revolution that we've seen over the last sort of 10 years or so. So it managed to ride that. But all I did was publish it on Amazon, and there used to be a thing where you could go on and give it away free on a Kindle for 3 days a month or something. So I did that. Somebody read it and liked it and recommended it and put a good review, and it just built up from there. So I've been incredibly fortunate with that, and I haven't done much else. I mean, obviously this is when you get invited to a podcast, say yes, because that's always a good one. But I mean, I've got like an Instagram account. I sort of dip in and out of it, but I'm not yeah, it's just not my thing. And I think I've accepted that whatever good I might be able to do by writing about a subject, I don't have the qualification or skills to like be a good marketer with it. I just sort of, yeah. So apologies,
I would
but
have thought.
that's a practical thing though. If you're publishing on Amazon, have a look, because there's a lot of marketing on there, so you can give the book away. I think there's an advertising thing. So, when you type in a search on Amazon and it comes up with sponsored products, you can set up this thing, depending on what people are searching for, to put your book up there. So again, that's worth having a look at, because you put in the search terms, like someone searches gambling addiction, it puts the book up, but you only pay for it if the person clicks it. And I assume there must be gambling addiction podcasts, so get in contact with them and send them a copy of the book. And yeah,
Kelly, have you got any more questions for William? That hour's flown over. Someone's just like pressed fast forward on the last hour, I think.
I've got so many questions, not only about Alcohol Explained, and I could speak to you all day about that. Diet and fitness, I've got to say as well. I mean, that was one of my favourite books. I've listened to it about three times now, actually. Honestly, it was really helpful. So we will need to have a discussion about that. It's all relative. It's the next step, and it's kind of the the direction that people go when they remove alcohol from their life. They start looking at their diet and their exercise. So yeah, hopefully we can get another conversation about that. But it's been absolutely brilliant today. Really has.
Fantastic. Thank you for inviting me.
William, if anybody wants to get in touch with you to, well, obviously in terms of getting your books, obviously it's probably a case of whacking alcohol explained into Google or whatever, and it'll take you to where you need to get to. But you've got a Facebook group as well, haven't you? And you do other platforms to help people out.
Yeah, absolutely. The Facebook group's very big. It's Alcohol Explained, obviously. If you go to the website, so the website is alcoholexplained.com, and I've got a link to my Instagram account. I think there's a link to the Facebook group. When you go in the Facebook group, you have to answer questions, and you don't get in unless you answer the questions. So just bear that in mind, because a lot of people just seem to apply to join, and obviously they don't get into the group. There's a significant number. But yeah, the website's a good place to start. And the first five chapters of Alcohol Explained are on there as well as a PDF. So if you are interested in reading more, you can go there and have a read.
What does the Facebook group do? Is it similar in any ways to what we do in terms of, is it a community that people can use as a continual go-to and something to keep involved with? How does it
You
tend to operate?
can do. It's very big. It's like 20 odd thousand now. So it's a big group. I kind of think that sometimes smaller is better. And I think if you're looking for a good community, it might be worth looking for something smaller. But it's great. I mean, I think it's okay. I'm not in there as much as I used to be. I used to be in there quite a bit, less so now. But yeah, it's people sort of supporting each other, asking questions, et cetera, et cetera. There seems to be a significant number of people who haven't actually read the book and don't know anything about it, which is a bit frustrating. But no, yeah, so I think people just use it as a sort of general sobriety group.
Do we know any well-formed communities, Kelly?
Oh God.
Little intimate ones where there's not that many people, and
Yeah,
can
I
you
was
think of
never
any?
Alcohol Uncensored. I've heard it's a really great community of supportive people. Yeah, we would love you to come and join us. And you can join for a month and give it a go. If you don't like it, leave. There is so many more communities out there as well. Just try and find your tribe. If there's anybody listening to this and they've tried to remove alcohol from their life, I say it all the time. If you've tried to remove alcohol from your life and you keep falling into old habits and you've never tried connecting with a community, come and give us a go. Me and Ian will jump on a Zoom with you as well, to tell you what it's all about and introduce you to the community. And we'll even point you to other communities if our community is not a fit for you after you've tried it. So yeah, you can find us at alcoholuncensored.co.uk.
Two things to do. Come and join us, come and have a chat with us, and read William's books. Read William's Alcohol Explained and Alcohol Explained too. If you like logic and you just know that this is absolutely bonkers, but you need it explained. And it's the sort of thing I keep going back to, William. I mean, I listened to it again today and I was just thinking, this is great. Even six years down the line, I'm still enjoying this because it's just so obvious. The things you say are just so, bang on. So thank you very much.
That's really good to hear. Thank you.
I know you hear this a lot, but your book was the one that sort of did it for me in terms of just making the penny drop. So thank you
Make a
very much for
difference.
that.
That's
And if you
fantastic.
like
Thank you.
the podcast, like and subscribe. You forgot that, Ian. And also as well, I've been posting some stuff on YouTube that I've been putting on Instagram and Facebook. So your face is on there as well, Ian. I forgot to tell you. So if anybody wants to see some videos, you can pop along to YouTube and see Ian's lovely cheery face.
I had my hair cut especially for William, if you noticed.
Yeah, I noticed you're looking good.
Oh, thank you. William, is there anything you can do to help promote us? If I say it now, then it's you've got to say yes. Anything you can do to
Yeah, I
help
have to. Yeah,
support
yeah.
that?
So here's the thing you can do. You can do when you're doing like little snips for Insta or whatever, you can do a collaboration. So you can invite Alcohol Explained to collaborate and then it goes up on my feed. And the great thing about that is I literally just have to push a button because I'm not very good with the tech side. So you could, if you set it up and as a collaboration post, and send it over, or it automatically gets sent to me, and then I can, say push a button and it'll be up on
Excellent.
my page as well then.
Thank you.
It's a collab, Kelly.
It's a
That's
collab.
a, as the kids would say, it's a collab. Brilliant. William, thank you very much. Really
No
appreciate
problem.
it.
Thank
Thanks for
you.
inviting me. Take
Kelly,
care.
I'll see you
Bye-bye.
soon. Thanks, guys. Bye, everybody.
Bye.